Hi, everyone. My name is Joe. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 1st, 1987. I have a sponsor and a home group. And I there's something interesting. I was thinking about this a couple weeks ago. I do have a sobriety date, a sponsor, and a home group, and I found those in the exact reverse order that I just said it. And I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, I came into AA and into sobriety not even really understanding anything about a sobriety date, or certainly not giving it any significant value in my life. And I learned a little bit about that by, I just sort of fell into a home group. And luckily for me, I fell into a very active group and got railroaded into getting somebody for a sponsor right away, and which was great because I didn't know what I was doing. And so I sort of found this home group, and then, you know, people helped me get a sponsor, and then I started to realize how important a sobriety date is. And that's my day. Every January 1st, that's my day, you know. It's not anybody else. Well, there's another guy in our group that's got January 1st, but he doesn't count. And you know, I've also, you know, I've been sober for 20 years. I just turned 40. My 20th birthday was my last drink, so the day after my 40th birthday was my 20th AA birthday. And it's marked a time where I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for half my life. And I've had actually the same sponsor that entire time, that poor man. And I was joking with him a little bit that he doesn't have any hair on the front anymore. And I always say it's from him, you know, from 20 years of him going, oh, my God. And because, you know, it takes a lot to be around me for 20 years. And I don't kid anybody about that. You know what I mean? I do the best I can with the steps and traditions and everything, but I'm a basic human being too. So there's, you know, there's stuff I've had to do in sobriety. And I am, as it relates to alcohol, what you would call a first nighter. And, you know, there's people out in the world who have drank a little bit or fooled around with it a little bit and then didn't and then did and then didn't and something else happened. But somewhere between the first night, the first time I ever put alcohol into my body, somewhere between my tongue and my stomach is the invisible line into alcoholism, because from that very moment on, I knew my relationship with alcohol was completely changed. And from the very first beer that I drank, that was the first thing I ever did, was the very first beer I drank, I immediately had the phenomenon of craving. And I can tell you 100% for sure, I didn't realize that was the phenomenon of craving until I had about 4 or 5 months of sobriety in the sobriety that I have now. It took me a little time to kind of learn about my illness. And it kind of leads into one of the things that I believe, that it's very difficult to say you came in on the second step if you don't have a full knowledge of your condition. And so it took me some time to actually get a first step, even though I was as desperate as anybody when I got sober in AA. But I think there's a little bit of education about what the illness actually is that needs to take place before I can concede to my innermost self that I really have this fatal malady and something better be done about it, or bad things are on the way. And so I'm a first nighter, and you know, that very first night I got a little taste of everything alcohol had to offer. I had the sense of euphoria, and unbeknownst to me, you know, I had the phenomenon of craving. I just thought I was getting thirstier and thirstier. And I lost control at all, you know, I had a lot of fun. There's a few things that I may or may not remember. And then, you know, later on, I discovered what happens when you lay down after you've drank way too much. And, you know, the bed started to spin, and then it started to flip a little bit, and I was like, we're in trouble. Just ran over to the bathroom, started doing my thing there, and then the local authorities came in, which was my mom. I was 15 years old. And, you know, the local authorities were all over me like white on rice, you know what I mean? Like, she's just standing over top of me, asking me question after question. Every now and then I would just look up, and the pointing and the question asking and the interrogation process. Well, it was almost more than I could bear. I just remember I just was screaming out, like, leave me alone, and I'll never do this again. And And at that moment, I was suffering pretty bad. I felt like it was possible that I would never do that again. But by the time I woke up the next day, and certainly by Monday morning when I was back at school, I couldn't wait to do it again. I mean, it was like the stories and everything that happened, everything that surrounded my new lifestyle that I had. And, as a kid, I mean, I kind of grew up, and I've always had friends. I've always had people that I was close to. But it was always only a few, you know, and I really felt isolated a lot of the time, and I had this some kind of a loneliness that later I think became something that binds all alcoholics together, which is this feeling of alcoholic loneliness, which I'll get to in a little while. But I always had some friends, you know, but it was kind of a few here and there, not a whole lot. And when I entered this new world of, you know, people who party, it was like I was in this new fraternity that was like school-wide, and everybody's like, dude, I heard you were crazy last night. That was awesome. And all this stuff, you know, and it was like I was in this whole new world, and I was this enthusiastic. It showed up in every – I was as enthusiastic about alcohol and learning about alcohol and how to have more of it in my life as anybody I've ever met. I mean, it showed up right away. I mean, I used to, you know, I've always been involved in stuff, and I'm kind of a, and I like to draw stuff, you know, and I would have my school folders, you know, just draw whatever on them, you know, and stuff. And, you know, it went from, like, drawing pictures of, like, bicycles and skateboarders and stuff that I was into, sports and whatever, to, like, you know, Budweiser labels, a Jim Beam bottle, you know what I mean? Stuff like, you know, there was a clear difference, and it happened right away for me. And so that's how I live my life. And I learned, I mean, it was like, it's funny, you know, there's some things that I've done in my life where I've been interested in something. I started to do it a little bit, and I found out, okay, there's some stuff you got to do, and you got to practice to get good at this. I never had to practice to get good at being alcoholic, finding alcoholics, finding out how to increase my alcoholism. That is something that has come completely natural to me. I never needed to read one piece of literature on that. And, I mean, I really, like, instantly, I the day I got into high school, I looked over and I saw this guy. His name was Dan. And he just looked like he was like my drinking sponsor, what he ended up becoming, you know. He just sort of showed me the ways of being a real sick alcoholic. And there was, this guy was like, he was like a good partier, you know, and he had something that made him pretty much the coolest guy in high school. He owned his own beer tap, and which made him the king of high school, evidently, because me and him would hang out Friday nights, and that's where we didn't have to find out where parties were. We were the first people that people called, you know, and because if you got a tap, you're saving somebody $25 for the rental and all that other crap. And it was insane, you know. But I knew how to, like, get around these people and do this stuff and increase my drinking and learn how to learn the ins and outs, you know, and learn the slogans, you know. Beer before liquor, you'll get sicker. Liquor before beer, never fear, you know, and all those things, which that formula totally sucks and it doesn't work at all. But, I've found that out. Yeah, I've retried it. I've tried it every angle you could possibly try that formula. It's not good. But, you know, but all that kind of stuff, I mean, I love that stuff. And, you know, and I've found every, you know, just, I loved to get drunk. And I didn't care if anybody was around or not. I mean, it's funny how I never really, you know, considered myself to be a loner or a solitary drinker, but it didn't matter to me whether other people were there or not. The drinking was going to happen. Just looking back on my life, I just loved it. I mean, I would get a bottle of Mad Dog, you know, and I had a bottle of Mad Dog in one cowboy boot and a bottle of Jim Beam in the other one, just sitting in my closet, you know, and I would just, you know, I'd save the Jim Beam for the weekend if I had to, because it just depends. I mean, when you're 15, 16 years old, it's getting a hold of $10 is rough. And, you know, and I was kind of working, but, you know, it's just like trying to go to school and stuff and whatever. I was just poor, you know what I mean? I didn't have nothing, so a $2.50 bottle of Mad Dog was kind of about my budget for weekday drinking, you know? And it's just that's just the way it had to be. And so I did plenty of that stuff, you know, and eventually I found some other stuff to kind of get me through the weekdays, you know, because coming into school in the morning with liquor on your breath, which I loved, and I loved beer too, but I loved whiskey, especially if I could get it in a fridge for a little while, get it chilled down so it would take a little bit of the heat off. You know, I love that stuff, but you can't really show up to school smelling like liquor. I mean, it's bad news. I found that out pretty much the hard way. And so what I did, you know, I would smoke and stuff like that and then go to school. And that kind of got me through to the end of the day until we could go out and do some serious partying and stuff like that. And so I learned how to maintain. I was learning how to, like, function in the world and stuff. And, you know, one of the weird things that happened was, you know, I was always kind of I would say like a C student, you know, and it was an interesting thing because I was always very sharp, but I was always looking to do the minimum to get by, and I just wasn't that motivated. I just didn't care that much, and you know, one of the things that happened, and I think some of it was just I just was kind of a itchy. I had just kind of had an itchy inside, you know, but after I started drinking and doing some of this other stuff, I really. It's a weird thing happened to me. I really started to relax, and I started to do much better in school. It was a really weird thing, and believe me, it did not last. But for like one calendar year, I was like doing better than I'd ever done in school. I think I might even made it on the honor roll like one or two times, one or two of the market periods or whatever. And so I was doing better than ever, which really was fueling my intensity for continuing this lifestyle. And one weird thing happened is at the end of my 10th grade year, I guess I was 16, my counselor had brought me into his office, and at the beginning of that year, he had brought me in and had a talk with me that he didn't really say anything, but at the beginning of that year, it sort of sounded like, you know, you seem like kind of a screwed-up kid, you know, and, you know, now you're in high school, it's time to focus, you know, because you really want to go to college, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of that year, after I had been just partying as hard as I ever could and trying to party more and more and more and more and more, you know, he brought me into his office, and he sat me down and he was like, you are doing, because I was really doing better and I was having more friends. It was kind of a weird reversal thing. And he was like telling me how great I was doing and everything. And I think he thought, at the beginning of the year, I was screwed up, and at the end of the year, I sort of straightened my life out, and the exact opposite was happening, which was another thing. When I left his office, I remember I was like, I've got him, you know what I mean? The game is working, man. I mean, you know, I've got it all. I just felt like I had learned the ropes, like I just achieved my master's license of alcoholism, you know? Like, I figured out how to function with this stuff, and you know, with the help of my sponsor, this guy Dan, and other, you know, other people that are helping me learn the ins and outs of, like, drinking as much as you can, as often as you can, as much as you possibly can, and still be able to function. But something happened at the end of that summer, you know, or between grades 10 and 11, something happened. I mean, I don't know whether one night I just went out, you know, and that last half gallon of Jim Beam just did me in, or what it was, but if something happened, you know, and I don't know if I lost a step or I burnt out a little something upstairs, but I went from having the best time of my life to I just remember feeling like I needed a drink, and I remember starting to feel this turning to where I had this inner sense that I was running out of time. Like something happened, and I just felt like this isn't going to last forever. The game really is a game. I mean, this is like I don't know. Maybe it was my conscience or something just telling me, because I, you know, historically for me also, you know, my conscience has just eaten me alive. Anytime I have done something where I generally hurt another human being or did something, I might have been able to, you know, show a little face and not have it of, you know, not show that it's affecting me, but that stuff would eat me alive in the middle of the night. And so maybe there was some of that happening, but something bad was happening. And I began to start to drink, to instead of drinking and having that sense of euphoria and the phenomenon of craving being something that as an experience seemed like this phenomenon was happening, but it was just hiding a great feeling, and it started to be this phenomenon was I couldn't overcome the phenomenon of craving, and I started to need to drink to oblivion to not have these negative thoughts and feelings and this sense of a separation from my fellow man that was starting to be a regular part of my inner life. And so 11th grade comes around. I don't show up for anything. I mean, my year, 11th grade year was a total wipeout and total loss. I think I might have had one credit for the whole year. And so there was big problems, and the sense that I was running out of time really was happening. And then the following year, and you know, my alcoholism got pretty bad. I mean, I was just doing as much as I could whenever I could, and trying to manage. And things were happening, bad things were happening. You know, early in my drinking, if I got too wasted or something, I either just like went to sleep somewhere, or just laughed a lot, or I just did something very benevolent. But that changed almost overnight to where, you know, I would get way too wasted and crash something, break something, wreck something, hurt someone. And I started to actually get a little bit of a reputation for this, for like, this guy's not that much fun anymore. And life of the party, not so much. And so, you know, I went through my 11th grade year, and then I turned 18, and this was during my senior year of high school. And it seemed like at age 18 and 4 seconds, the police showed up. You know what I mean? And like before then, it was like I was always getting off on stuff. Like it was nothing ever happened. They would come, they would give me a talkative, they'd be like, you know, you're an idiot, and send me home or whatever. But literally, it's like the day I turned 18, it was like, you know, a fax came into the local police station, you know, Joe Snyder is now 18, you know, we got to keep an eye on him. So I got busted a couple times for little stuff. And well, actually, one of them was a DUI, and one of the few times that I was totally wasted and didn't crash into something. And so I got that, and I got a couple other little petty things from being really wasted and doing stupid stuff. And so I started getting in trouble, and that wasn't the only thing. I mean, friends of mine were making statements like, "When you drink, you just get really nasty," and that wasn't really that great to hear. And I also really was starting to drink in a way that was not just alcoholic, but also very, very unsafe. I mean, I was somebody who, well, a fifth of whiskey no longer made me feel comfortable for hours on end. Like, if I had a fifth of whiskey in my hand, I had to figure out how, by the end of the night, I was going to have some other stuff to kind of stabilize me. Like, I needed to have, like, another 12-pack of beer. And so I started to really try to get, if I had a half gallon, I knew that was more than even more than I could drink in a night. And so I would have some for the morning and all that stuff. But I started to drink in a way where, there's on more than one occasion I drank at least a fifth of alcohol in less than a half an hour, and that's kind of dangerous to do. And my friends would be like, "Wow, you're a mess. You know, this is not good. You can't be doing this kind of stuff." And on those particular evenings, I had some real bad experiences. So all this was happening all at once. You know, I turn 18. I'm in all this trouble. I'm drinking like a man possessed, and my life is already in shambles. I mean, I had to endure really another almost 2 years by the time, you know, I had gone to court and all this stuff before I actually, you know, made it in here. But luckily for me, there's, you know, maybe God looks out for drunks and babies, you know. I mean, I never got into anything that was really too bad, you know, or, you know, I've crashed cars, and I mean, it looked like a NASCAR. One of my crashes was, I was about 50 miles from where I was supposed to be at that moment, and had woken up out of a, you know, after taking a nap on 495, and my car was like, I had three flat tires, and every single inch of metal on that car was scratched or dented in some way. And, of course, I was fine. But I was starting to have, you know, there's stuff like that was happening a lot. And luckily for me, you know, as things would have it and going to court dates and stuff, I started to have to really listen to my attorney. And, you know, in order to stay, you know, really out of jail and not just out of trouble. So one of the things they signed me up for was like an alcohol awareness class. And I had to go to some AA classes. And I didn't know that there – I mean, I was a drinker, and that's pretty much what I focused on. So when somebody said AA, I didn't understand what a meeting – I just thought it was a class. You come into AA, you learn some stuff, and then you leave. And, you know, so it took me a little while to figure out what AA meeting meant and stuff like that. And so I had to go to some classes and get some stuff signed and stuff, and then go to this alcohol awareness thing, and which was like a, I don't know, I think it was a 20-something week course. I think it took about 4 or 6 months, something like that. But which I actually learned some stuff about alcoholism, physiologically anyways. Not so much the way it's explained in the book by Dr. Silkworth with the phenomenon of craving and so on, but I did learn that after coming into AA. And but, you know, it's amazing how it kind of blows me away a little bit. I am an alcoholic. I mean, all the way to my tiptoes, I am very alcoholic. I've got this thing. But when I came to probably 30 or 40 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and nothing got in because I really didn't want it to. I mean, I was desperate, but there's nothing, and this really seals the coffin on the fact that I'm an alcoholic. There's nothing I can ever remember wanting to work out more for me than a life which included alcohol. Nothing. I can't think of any other thing that I longed for having this, please let this work. This is the only thing that's ever saved me from me, is what it ended up being. I didn't know what it was saving me from, but it was just saving me. And, you know, alcohol was the ultimate solution to every problem, puzzle, and vexing thing about this, the, you know, what it is to be alive. And, but it was not really working out, but, you know, so the meetings, I really wasn't hearing much. And as things would have it, you know, it's a lot like staying sober and not doing your four step. You know, life kind of narrows down to where it's the only thing left to do. And, so, you know, my life started to really narrow down. And, by the time I was 19 years old, something happened where I just kept going to summer school and night school until I graduated high school, which I can't even believe I ever did that. I mean, I just can't believe I never persevered or finished anything, but somehow I finished that. It's just like, it's miraculous. And it was definitely a higher power involved in my life somewhere. But I was 19 years old. I was a bum. I mean, I had a job. I mean, I pretty much worked since I was 14, but I had a job, but I was a bum. I mean, I'd be hard pressed to say I was contributing to society. So, you know, if I say that, you know, I get a little twitch. So I was 19 years old. I was a total disaster. That's what was happening. And I was in the middle of, you know, still trying to get out of trouble. And so, as I turned 19, I could not drink without this incredible desire to drink for oblivion. So I started to do this process where I would try to white knuckle and not drink for a couple, 3, 4, 5 days as long as I could, and then I would just have a blowout and just drink my head off, and then try to come to, and then try to, you know, straighten up and do right, because internally, like I said, you know, my conscience has always been right there to torture me, you know, if I felt like I wasn't living right in some way. And it was just unbearable. And I started to wake up with these things that I can only identify with as night terrors, where I would wake up in bed from a full sleep and would, like, run across the room, and I just would be experiencing terror. And I was just so afraid of what was what I, you know, there's a couple things. You know, what I had become, I had no idea where I was going. I felt so directionless. I had no idea what my life was adding up to, and I was so terrified to move forward in life. And I was really did not really feel like I had the world in the palm of my hands at all. I felt like I was just an out of control train, and there was no way I could put on the brakes, and there was no way I could stop this. And I knew, if I was convinced of anything, it's that this train was out of control and was going in a very bad direction. And so I was had all this going on, and I really, actually during my 19th year, I did try a couple times to go to a couple meetings, and I was like, maybe if I stop drinking, I'll feel better. And I proved that that was a total disastrous analysis, because I did stop drinking for like two and a half weeks, and I don't know about anybody else, but I came to realize this later, and I'll talk about it a little bit more later, but I have actually taken a drink before to preserve my own sanity, just at the point where I felt like I was going to lose my mind and maybe hurt myself or somebody else. I have taken a drink to quiet that madness, and so I started to do, I was doing that. I was in the process of doing that, and I didn't really realize it. I was just trying to do as best I could to not, you know, live in this insane madness, and then I would get crazier and crazier the longer I would be not drinking, and then I would just have a blowout. And you know, once the, you know, the state of mind that precedes the first drink, then the phenomenon of craving, then the episode, and then the disaster, and then try to pick up the pieces. You know, it's like this process, like getting drunk, getting sober, over and over and over and over, and that'll wear you out. I felt like I was, I mean, I'm 40 years old now, and at age 20 when I got sober, I felt like I was, I mean, I felt like I needed a cane. That's what I felt like. And, I mean, I was not feeling young and inspired and ready to take on the world and at the beginning of a life that was filled with possibility, I can assure you. And so the end of that year, you know, just prior to getting sober, my last 3 months of drinking, I think I only drank like 4 or 5 times. But I guarantee you every single one of those times was a complete disaster of alcoholism. I mean, you know, the whole thing, pick up the drink, the phenomenon of craving, everything that was happening, you know, and I was losing my mind. And by this time I had devastated my probation. I mean, it was like probation. I already had court dates and stuff, and I wasn't even opening up, you know, the envelope that tells you when your court date is and stuff. I just kind of was really, really, really in full flight from reality. And so somehow what happened was a cousin of mine came into town from Virginia Beach. He was serving in the Navy, and he had been sober for a couple of years. And he came into town. He was spending the Christmas holiday with me and my family because his family was somewhere else. I can't remember. But I hung out with him, and I didn't drink for a week with him. You know, it was just, I hung out with him, and that was okay for whatever reason. I wasn't, maybe it's just I wasn't isolated or something, but I hung out with him. I didn't drink. Then I went out New Year's Eve. He had left. He left New Year's Eve day. Somebody called me, and New Year's Eve is my birthday, and one of my friends had called and said, we got the setup. You coming down? I said, yeah, you know, which is, you would get a suite every year, and we would go and basically tear up some hotel and then leave. And so this was all set up and ready to go. And I remember thinking, I'm going to have 2 drinks and not doing any drugs tonight and no girls. I'm not chasing any girls. It's done. I'm just going to have a nice evening. And it went like every other, it was, everything just got shattered to pieces just like everything else. And I had this moment of clarity. It was about 10 o'clock at night after I drank like, I don't know, 6 or 8 beers. And I was running, I just had this moment of clarity. I just woke up like, right, I was running down the hallway to go get high with these girls after drinking all this beer. And I was like, I just knew it was, I was living in insanity. And then, of course, I just was like, ah, whatever, you know, and went and did my thing. But I was at the party, and it was just after midnight. And I hadn't had anything for a while because I got hammered really early on and just was like, said too much in my system. So I was sitting on the edge of this couch and I knew I was doomed. It was like, there's a part of the book where this guy, Roland, goes overseas and this very famous doctor tells him that he's doomed. And he said, I feel like the gates of hell closed on me. And that was kind of the experience I was having in that moment. And so I went back home the next day, and this guy Chuck Z talks about an experience that he had where he was emptied out of himself. He had no longer had any ego. And I don't know if I was totally there, but I felt like something had been completely taken away from me at that moment. And it was not replaced by hope, at least not for a couple of weeks or whatever. Because what happened was I stayed sober for 10 days, another period of white knuckle sobriety, which was just awesome. Being not drinking after you drink like a maniac alcoholic, for the first week it's awesome because, you know, you feel like, wow, you know, maybe that, you know, it just, things physically start getting a little bit better. But then after a week, then it's the mental, emotional, and spiritual stuff that really starts to get agitated. And so I'm 10 days sober, and that's where I'm at, you know. Physically, I'm fine. I was kind of detoxing a little bit because, I kind of tapered towards the end. I was just having these really bad episodes every couple weeks. So physically, I was okay, but I was losing my mind. And I was 10 days sober, and I had this moment with myself where I said, I can't go on like this. I made the realization that is the realization that happens within the first step, at least my understanding of it. I realized I could not go on with this drinking madness anymore. I could not continue to live the way I was living. But I also knew, and it was as much of a conviction as the first one, that I could not stay sober. I just knew it. I was like, how do you get out of a trap that you can't possibly escape from? I decided to try one meeting, one night, one time. I went to a 6 o'clock meeting. It was the same, it wasn't a speaker's meeting, but it was at 6 o'clock, 6 to 7 o'clock. And I got there at 7 o'clock. And everybody stood up and they were standing. I don't know if you guys do the praying in the circle, but they were standing up and they were praying in a circle and they were saying, Our Father. And I walked in the door and they split up to let me be in the circle. And as soon as the circle opened up, I started to share. I kind of knew I was breaking the rules, but I need some help. And I was freaking out. And I said, my name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic, and I am in a really, really bad place. If somebody could please talk to me after the meeting, I'd really appreciate it. And everybody's real nice. They stopped praying. Then afterwards, they took my hand, and we finished the prayer. And I was surrounded by Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it was amazing. These guys, I mean, I was probably surrounded by 10 guys, you know. And they came and they actually took me out to this local pancake house, and they have sort of a formula that they do. They give you 3 or 4 pancakes, coffee, and then, you know, while you're sitting there paralyzed, because, like, I never ate. Are you kidding me? You have a couple of pancakes and, like, a half a gallon of syrup and then some coffee. I mean, I was in a daze. And then they just started pitching AA to me, you know, like crazy. And, I, you know, it was a combination of things, like, I mean, I was as near to being suicidal as I've ever been in my life at that evening. And these guys, a combination of how enthusiastic they were about their own lives and knowing that they really did want me to, like, keep hanging out with them. Excuse me. They inspired me. I mean, I was like, all right, I'm gonna give it a try. I'm gonna come back tomorrow or whatever. Because they kept asking me, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? What are you doing tomorrow? And so I made plans with them, and we started to hang out. Guys, water. Yeah, thanks. And so I started hanging out with these guys. You know, it was a couple of young guys, and we started running around together every day, and. after about a couple weeks, one of the guys, this guy named Carl, who had, I think he had 3.5 months, and he basically knew everything about AA, how it worked, all the steps, everything. He knew everything. 3.5 months. And then he railroaded me into getting this guy for a sponsor. He's like, yeah, get this guy Frank, get this guy Frank. So I didn't know Frank. I heard Frank share one time, and I was like, all right, hey, dude, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah, and I thought it was my idea. I thought I'd, like, went through the interview process and picked him out and stuff. And, man, it was a total railroad setup. I mean, these guys had already arranged it. They talked to Frank. They said, we're going to bring him into the kitchen. He's going to ask you and blah, blah, blah. So the whole thing was set up. But it made it seem like it was my idea, which I love that. I mean, if you're going to be an alcoholic and you get sober and you need, like, to vent some craftiness, you know, they were actually helping somebody, you know, get saved from alcoholism, you know, by using that kind of craftiness that we have as something we bring in here a lot of times. And so I got this guy Frank, and he's been my sponsor ever since. And you know, we pretty much immediately went into action. I mean, he's kind of a no bones guy, and I mean, he wasn't really domineering over me or anything. He just said, "This is what we're going to do." He's like, actually, the first thing he said to me, I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, can you take direction? I was like, what? He said, can you take direction? I said, yeah, I can take direction. He said, okay. He said, you know, you got to call me, and there's some stuff we're going to do. And he had 2.5 years sober, so basically everything he said sounded like Chinese to me. The guy Carl with 3.5 months, I understood perfectly. he really knew everything. And now, I mean, looking back on it now, that terrifies me to think that was kind of how I was thinking. But little by little, my sponsor started to make more sense as Carl started getting weird. So I would go to my sponsor's house, and, you know, one of the first things we learned was called post time, which at the racetrack is when you got to get your money in for your bets or whatever. And post time at his house meant be there at 7:30. What post time didn't mean was be there at 7:31. Because at 7:31, it's like, where is everybody? You know, they're already gone. They went to the meeting. So I learned that pretty quick. That only took a couple weeks. I was kind of burnt out. I mean, I really had some, my mental capacities were, you know, I was damaged goods. I was what you would call functionally illiterate. I could read words on a page, but I couldn't understand what I was reading. I couldn't tell you a single thing if I read a paragraph of what I just read. And so that took a little time. And I couldn't find our meetings. You know, we had all these meetings, you know, seven days, seven meetings. It's a lot to keep track of. And like 4 or 5 of them were on the same road. I mean, like a 2-mile stretch of Connecticut Avenue, which is, you know, it's a pretty straight road. And I just would get it all confused, and that took a little while, too. But I started following this guy's direction, started going over to his house, showing up when I was asked to show up. I was going to meetings very early, staying very late, and I was going to a ton of meetings. I mean, I in my first year, I mean, I had to go to 2 meetings a day, and on the weekends I would go 3 or 4, because I needed a place, a safe place to sit down. And I was terrified, you know. Back in the olden days when I got sober, we didn't have mobile phones, you know. It was like somebody had one, but it looked like a backpack, you know what I mean? It was giant. So, you know, we didn't have that stuff. So I'd be afraid to be at the house because the phone would ring and it'd be one of my old friends. And I don't know who has experience with this, but I have picked up the phone and noticed how personality changed when it was an old friend of mine, and that scared the hell out of me. Once I actually got in here, and I was, you know, and I had this guy Frank as my sponsor, and I passed my world record of sobriety, which was like 3 weeks. You know, I had my 30-day chip in my pocket. I'm rolling. You know what I mean? Once I experienced this idea that maybe possibly there's an outside remote chance that this program will work for me. And once I had that experience, even just that little glimpse of that, I did not want to go back to my alcoholic life more than anything else. I did not want to go back no matter what. I remembered what it was like at the end. I remembered how I felt and the kind of thoughts I was having. and that unbearable separation from my fellow man, and that sense of alcoholic loneliness for which there is no answer. And there is one, but when you're in the middle of it, there's no answer for it, that's for sure. And so I was doing everything I could, you know, and me and my sponsor were slowly working through the steps, and we started reading the big book together, and which actually parlayed into a Tuesday night meeting that we call Tuesday Big Book. And that's a big book meeting that started in my sponsor's living room with me and him. And how it would work is we would sit down and read through the big book. If I had a question about a word, I looked it up in the dictionary. And if he had a question about a word, I looked it up in the dictionary. Yeah, that's the big book study. And now we do that on every Tuesday night. And that's been going for about 17 years. And so I was young and crazy and sober, you know, my first year of sobriety. And I started learning about this first step, like I was saying, you know. I started learning about the physical allergy, you know, this phenomenon of craving and how it's limited to this class of people. And I started to be able to see it in my own life and be able to identify it in my story. And I started identifying with stories in the big book, with Bill's story and some of these other things. And there's something, in, I can't remember what chapter it's in now. It's early. I think it's in There's a Solution. But it described an alcoholic that drank exactly like I drank. Like this kind, this type of alcoholic drinks like I drank, feels like I felt. And I started seeing this in the book after the reading comprehension came back. You know, the functional literacy had to go away. But it talks about the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'd actually had somebody call me that in my drinking days. Like, you are like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, son. I was like, you know, whatever. You know, he's seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. And so there was, I was reading stuff in the book that, and there's a few things in the book that I have read that the words came off the page, went inside me, went right into my heart, and I knew that I needed to be here like I've never needed anything else. And then later in the book where it talks about the hideous four horsemen, and it mentions the major, my foe. So the first word of the hideous four horsemen is terror. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Those were my constant companions at the end. And I just knew that I needed to do this thing. And so I'm doing the best I can as a young man, getting sober, trying to go through the steps, you know. 20 years old, I didn't have a whole lot of life experience and stuff, but I was reading and I was trying to do some things. And eventually I did a four-step, and how that looked was I wrote down one thing, then I hid my four-step under my bed for about 3 months. And like I was saying earlier, as things would have it, you know, when the four-step is what there is to be done, life has a way of funneling itself way down until one day I was like, I think I need to finish my four-step, you know, because I had like, you know, it's just like all the areas of life that see all the things that I used for security seemed to be like suddenly floating away. I was like, uh-oh. So I did my four-step out of spiritual values, not out of desperation, a wish. You know, it's like a lot of things, you know. Pain is a pretty good touchstone to spiritual growth. And so I did that. And I took a fifth step, which I was terrified to do. And I had an experience. And I want to back up just a little bit. Right, the moment I took what I consider myself taking the third step at death, where I equate it as an experience as a time in my life when I turned my back on self, a life of self-centeredness. And I am self-centered, but the direction of my life is going away from a life of self-centeredness from that day to this day. I have never from that moment to this moment experienced alcoholic loneliness, a loneliness for which there is no answer. I get lonely sometimes, but it never at that depth, and I know that there's an answer now. So I did the fourth step. I take this fifth step with my sponsor, and I did it as good as I could. And it must have been pretty thorough, because on the back side of that, I had probably 2 months of just euphoric happiness. And I had another experience. You know, I had been, you know, from a very early time in Alcoholics Anonymous, a member in good standing, which meant I was at a ton of meetings. I was calling my sponsor. I was trying to help people, and I was doing service work and stuff. But I didn't feel like a member in good standing. I still felt like I just still had that inner voice that was just like, you know what, whatever, you're nothing. And that changed after doing that fifth step. I was able to sit very deep in my chair in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew I was a part of, and I knew I felt like I belonged. And I've kept going with the steps, you know. And I mean, today, two of the most important steps for me. I don't want to say that. I try to incorporate all the steps in my life, but when I think about in terms of building character and what I'm doing with my life as a man living in the world, I think an awful lot about steps 6 and 7. And so I did some initial work on 6 and 7 and moved on. And by the time I did my 8-step list, I really wanted to be sober and to grow spiritually. So what happened to me was like this weird, you know, experience, and I've heard other people share this. The minute I finished my 8-step list, I went over with my sponsor. He crossed off 2 of the names and left the rest. And literally within 48 hours, people just started coming out of the woodworks. I mean, it was unbelievable. Like, just people I hadn't seen for years. I just wrote their name on this sudden list. And I mean, I was just sure that I was never going to see him again, and they just started coming off the page. And you know, I mean, I ran into one guy at a traffic light. He had a fireman's boot in his hand. He was collecting for some charity thing, and I was a guy I hated. And we buried the hatchet in under whatever, however long it takes from a light to go red to go green again. We had that amends was made, and the hatchet was buried, and whatever. And so I had many experiences like that, and I had an experience with my mom. You know, where that was kind of, you know, a lot of my family was like, there wasn't any, I didn't steal anything. I didn't have, like, where I wrecked somebody's car and I needed to pay him back for a car or whatever. It was a living amends. What we call in our group is a living amends. And so I'd been doing this living amends with my mom. I go over every Wednesday night and I do whatever my mom wants to do on Wednesday night. And then I go to my meeting. And one day I was pulling in the driveway and she's out in the yard. She's working on her garden. And she turned around, and she just smiled and said hi, and I had this moment of clarity where there was no longer any apprehension in that woman's eyes. She was not afraid of what I was doing. There was no sense of disappointment, because prior to that, people in my family, it was always, every holiday was somebody's turn to pull me aside and have the talk, which is like, what are you doing with yourself, man? You're a disaster. You know, and my mom was always, you know, kind of waiting for the phone to ring and just, you know, it was uncomfortable to be around me because my life was going in this bad direction and that was completely gone. And I knew the amends were made, and I also, you know, I just had this tremendous, overwhelming feelings of gratefulness, you know, that AA had done so much with me. And I've kept going from there. You know, I engage in some prayer and meditation. I have little practices that I do. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, most people just encourage you to experiment with it because there's a lot of valuable stuff out there, and it's awesome thing to get into. And moving on to the 12 step, I actually started doing 12 step work very early on, and I had about a month and a half when my sponsor started me out on it. And he said, I was a month and a half of sobriety. I was complaining to him about how my life is in ruins and how, you know, I needed, like, lawyers, guns, and money, that old song. And he informed me. He said, you are ready. And I was like, I'm ready? And I'm thinking it's going to be something good, but it never is. He said, you are ready to start working with newcomers. I was like, I just remember the internal argument was like, are you insane? But outwardly, I was like, all right, you know, I just felt like, what's next? You know, what could possibly be next? But he said, you know, and he explained to me that my job was not to carry a message. He said, I want you to go get the mess and then bring yourself and the mess to the message. So you just go pick people up, give them cigarettes. And I became a local taxi service and dispenser of free cigarettes to newcomers. I mean, that's kind of what I did. And that was good 12-step work, and I've carried it a little further than that. You know, I have a little system where I sit down and take my guys through the book, and I have a little bit of a different system with somebody who doesn't know anything about AA. And then, you know, I tend these days to get a lot of retreads, you know, guys who've been around and maybe they're, you know, over doing nothing for years, you know, and then they're like, oh, I decided I might need some recovery. And so we sit down, we go through the book, and I just take out some of the examples and get down to the meat and potatoes kind of text in there. And we go through the steps of the program, and it's serious stuff. And the reason why I think it's so serious for me is because it totally transformed my life. It has done something for me that nothing else has ever done for me. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try as best I can to be a respecter of the traditions. And I can't even say how much of a believer I am. I wouldn't consider doing it any other way than the way I do it and the way we do it in our group, because I see people's lives get transformed every day. And I don't mean just stopping drinking and going on living like a drunk. I mean people who for all intents and purposes look like they might have absolutely no potential, get sober, have these repaired relationships, go on and be successful members of their societies, their friendships, their family lives and stuff like that. I mean, I've met some of the most awesome people that I've known anywhere in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I really consider myself the benefactor of great fortune, and I want to thank you guys for having me out and listening to me share. Thanks.